For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have giving a talk this evening Will Kunert, who's our intern from the UC Divinity School, practicing with us now. And thank you very much, Will, for giving a talk tonight.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I forgot that I get introduced, so I guess I'll skip that part. So tonight I'm going to be talking a bit about my time that I had a couple years ago in Southeast Asia and the experiences I had with Buddhism there. It's pretty appropriate because it was discussions of Vietnam and Thailand, which were the first thing that I bonded over with John Burlow, who we're remembering this evening. So just to give like a brief overview of this trip that I did, it was about 2 years, well, geez, when was it now? 2.5 years ago that I left, and I spent 8 months in Southeast Asia with Flora, my wife, then girlfriend. We began in Vietnam, we traveled to Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand. Specifically, I'm kind of going to be talking about my experiences with Buddhism there. So just to give a sort of brief overview about where I was in terms of my path with Buddhism and meditation beforehand. Before I left, I was sort of just beginning to consider sort of whatever you would call it, declaring myself a Buddhist or going by the term Buddhist. I'd been practicing meditation for maybe 4 years before that, but had always been very hesitant to actually sort of ascribe myself to any specific tradition. I liked meditating a lot. I liked hanging out with meditators, and they most of the time happened to be Buddhists. But I myself didn't feel comfortable going by that term. And so I kind of, even though our trip wasn't planned to be centered around Buddhism, I knew that, or imagined that going to Southeast Asia, I would be exposed to Buddhism in a way that might help me figure out what it meant to be a Buddhist and if that was something I wanted to explore. Let's see if there's any. So arriving in Vietnam, it was interesting because I expected to, as I've kind of been hinting at, run into a lot of Buddhists and interact with Buddhist culture a lot, and instead had a very hard time meeting any Buddhists. Instead I had people come up to me and they would see that I was white, basically, and from the West, and they would say, "Oh, so are you Christian?" And I would say, "Oh, no, I'm actually Buddhist." And they would go, "Oh." And I'd say, "Oh, are you Buddhist?" And I'd say, "Oh, no, I'm Christian." So that was very funny, because there's not like a lot of Christians there, but they would see me, and they would think I was Christian, and I would see them, and I would think they were Buddhist. And so it took me a while to be able to find anyone who actually was a Buddhist practitioner. And even when I did go to the Buddhist temples that were in the city or in the local area, and you know, I had this expectation that I would see everyone sort of sitting around in meditation and being, you know, the sort of Buddhist that I imagined I wanted Buddhism to be, and instead it was, you know, these temples with sort of giant idols, and people would be there praying desperately for, you know, I found out often wealth and success, which were all these things which I had associated with the parts of religion I really didn't like, which was a very interesting experience because I, you know, felt like I was in a Buddhist country. These people were raised Buddhist. They had a much greater claim to be Buddhist than I did, yet they seemed to embody all these things which I didn't want to identify with. And so I remember talking with Laura about how maybe we weren't Buddhist because this wasn't something we were interested in. But that's not the end of the story. So, we luckily found out that the director of our program because we were there teaching English, and the director of the program was actually himself a Buddhist, one of the few that we found, and that he had been actually a monk even for a few months at a monastery just a few hours away from the city that we were living in. And he said that he had an opportunity to teach English to the monks if we wanted to. And so we, you know, with some pushing and prodding, he finally agreed to let us do that. And as we were on our way there riding the bus, I remember we asked him, you know, what level English the monks were at and if there was any lesson plans he recommended. And he kind of just said something like, oh, you probably won't be doing any English teaching, just meditating. And we were kind of like, oh, well, okay, like, that's cool, I guess. And indeed, we got there, and they had no idea who we were and no idea that we were coming, and our director had abandoned us. So we were just these two random Americans at this Vietnamese monastery where there was just a small handful of people who spoke any English. And they let us stay there for 10 days. Maybe they would have let us stay longer. We stayed there for 10 days. And had a really amazing sort of experience. Sort of finally saw the Buddhism that I was kind of always hoping existed, in a sense. And it was a very humbling experience because going there, I kind of had this idea that I was this hotshot meditator. You know, I didn't have a lot of people to compare myself to, not that that's what you should be doing in this practice at all, but that is what I did as an undergrad, and I thought I was pretty good. But then I, you know, met these people who had, not only had they completely devoted their lives to this path, but, you know, they regularly woke up at 3 a.m. In fact, every day they woke up at 3 a.m. to meditate for an hour, and meditated for an hour before going to bed, and chanted for 45 minutes every day. And many of the monks actually meditated for several hours at a time, which I just found mind-blowing and very humbling. Another thing that was kind of very enjoyable about being in the Vietnamese monastery when we were there is that up to that point, we'd already been in Vietnam for a couple months, and I had eaten many mysterious things, and I had kind of discovered the limit of what I was comfortable eating, and had thus begun to feel very uncomfortable with a lot of the food that I was being exposed to. But I knew that in the Vietnamese monastery, everything was vegetarian. So even if there was sort of mysterious things in the bowl, I knew that they were just some weird mushroom or vegetable, which was made it a lot easier. So we had this really incredible time in this Vietnamese monastery, and it was a sort of profound enough experience that we decided to sort of shift the focus of our trip so that it was no longer going to be about just teaching English, and instead we wanted it to focus more on Buddhism and meditation, at least that we could, the opportunities that we could find. And it was actually to some degree surprisingly difficult to find opportunities. We were planning to go to Laos and Cambodia afterwards, and doing some research online, found it so difficult to find opportunities there that we decided to also include Thailand in our trip because there was many opportunities there as well. And it was interesting because the next place we went after Vietnam was Laos. And although there was many Buddhists there, it's an incredibly Buddhist country, even more so than Vietnam to a great degree. It was very hard to find people, again, who actually meditated. And we even, when we were in one of the city centers, we went to one of the little monasteries and we were asking one of the young monks if they did any meditation and if we could come. And he kind of said sternly, no meditation, just praise Buddha. And I was kind of like, oh, well, okay, I don't know what that is. So, and so we didn't have many experiences with Buddhism in Laos and Cambodia other than sort of seeing the culture, seeing many of the monastics. Got to, you know, give alms to some of the monastics in their alms rounds. But the sort of opportunity that we did find in Cambodia was a 10-day Goenka retreat, which we decided to do. And for those of you who don't know what Goenka is, he's a teacher, a Burmese Indian teacher. He's since passed away, but he has many, many centers around the world that lead sort of intensive retreats where you watch his videos of his teachings. And we decided to participate in this, and it was 11 days or 10 days of complete silence, no eye contact, waking up at 4 a.m. and meditating until more or less 10 p.m. with just a few breaks in between. And this, again, was another very humbling experience because it was so hard, basically. It was incredibly hard, but also incredibly rewarding. And it was at a really sort of important time for me and my practice and where I was in the path, because I was just sort of, for the first time, deciding that maybe I would sort of be open-minded to exploring and embracing the parts of Buddhism that I maybe didn't before feel comfortable doing. You know, these include sort of like the moralistic precepts, which I'd always kind of felt uncomfortable about. I didn't like people telling me what to do. Or even in general doing what you were instructed to do at a retreat in terms of meditation. I kind of thought, well, I'll just do my own thing. You guys can all do your little silly breathing meditation. As well as certain sort of philosophical ideas like suffering, the first noble truth, or no self, two ideas which didn't necessarily resonate with me very naturally. But I was kind of at a point where I was finally deciding to maybe just give it a shot, just to like maybe I'll like open up to those things. And it kind of worked in tandem with the format of the Goenka retreat, because one of the things they really emphasize is that you're not supposed to do anything other than what they tell you to do in terms of the practice. Don't do other techniques, don't even like do Tai Chi or yoga, they request. And so it kind of worked together that I really did sort of dive into the practice, a distinctly sort of Buddhist practice for the first time when I was on that retreat. And I found it incredibly rewarding. Let's see. One of the sort of funniest parts about the end of that retreat was just even hearing your voice for the first time in 11 days. It kind of sounds like when you first hear your voice in a video or recording of you. It comes out of you and you kind of go like, oh, what is that? Is that my voice? And so it was a very intensive experience, and it sort of just after that, we decided to go to a monastery in Thailand where we spent 2.5 months living there, just sort of living the monastic lifestyle. I didn't ordain or anything, even though that is something that I could have done. In their culture, it's very common to sort of just ordain for a month or even a week, but I didn't do that. But I did just sort of live in the lifestyle there. And my experience at the monastery in Thailand was also a really rewarding experience. It was one of the most beautiful places I've just ever been. And there was an amazing teacher there who was a man who just sort of, when he was maybe 30 or something, after 10 years of being a monk, just decided to go off into the jungle way up in the hills of Thailand and meditate in a cave. And he didn't sort of make any proclamations about, oh, I have this truth and people should come here or anything like that. He was just meditating up in this cave, and over the course of a couple decades, people just sort of came to him. And, you know, when I arrived 20 years after he had first arrived there, there was this whole sort of monastery built up just around him. It wasn't a huge monastery, but, you know, it was dormitories for men and women, a number of kutis or like little huts for monks to live in, a beautiful meditation hall and pond, and it was just a very sort of wonderful place. And it was also the place where I really began to sort of embrace the tradition as a whole and wrestle with sort of some of the ideas I had been resistant to before. And one of the things that I found really the most remarkable about my time in Thailand, both at the monastery and just of Thai people in general, was their generosity. I had the opportunity twice to go on an alms round, which for those of you who don't know is sort of an ancient tradition where monks or ordained people take basically a begging bowl and they go into the village and, you know, it's not like they knock on people's doors and ask, like, hey, can I please have some food? They just kind of go stand outside places and just stand there. And so it's kind of this really beautiful ceremony where they're not sort of begging in like a pitiful way, but it's an extremely humbling experience at the same time, because in their culture, monks are extremely well respected and looked up to. Yet when they go on these alm rounds, they take off their shoes and walk down this gravelly road, which is a painful experience in and of itself, and go ask or stand there for food. And it was so amazing because these people had so little, these people who lived up in the hills, in the villages around them, especially compared to, you know, me coming from America with my, you know, Apple computer back home and, you know, my $700 flight back to the United States and all the things that I had. Yet you'd go on these alm rounds and these relatively, you know, poor people would give you their best crops, or they'd make you, like, you know, a huge amount of their favorite pad thai and put it into the bowl. In some ways I felt like a little bit guilty, but more than anything it was just a beautiful and humbling experience, because it was clear that to the people who were giving to us, this brought them immense joy. It didn't seem like a sense of obligation that they're kind of like, okay, these people are coming by again, but rather that they were overjoyed to have this opportunity to give. And I saw that generosity just time and again. After 2.5 months there, they never once even sort of asked us for money or even brought that up. We obviously gave them at that time for us, a sizable donation at the end. But they just sort of gave. They gave us a place to sleep, they gave us food, they gave us teachings. And it was really beautiful to see this cycle of the generosity, that these villagers would give and give. And, you know, one time even there was some ceremony, and so people were sending an extra large amount of food to the temple. And so we had all this food, and after a couple weeks, we just clearly weren't going to be able to eat it all. And so we decided to put it into these huge bags and drive out into, like, the countryside, and we just gave it back to, like, different villagers. And so it was just this beautiful sort of cycle of they would give to us, we would give back to the villagers, they would give back to us. And in each experience, there was just so much joy that was occurring as all this giving was happening. Another one of the most sort of amazing experiences of generosity that I saw is that one sort of late afternoon when I was there, there was this extremely intense storm that, like, blew down all these trees and broke windows, and it happened over the course of probably a half hour, but it was really intense, and there was these downed trees all over the place. And I remember looking at the situation and just wondering, like, oh my God, like, what are we going to do? How are we going to, you know, pick this up? Because they don't have... it's not like the city's going to come pick it up. That's just not a thing out there. They laughed, I think, when I asked about that. But within 10 minutes after the storm ended, already some villagers just started showing up on, like, you know, motorbikes or in a truck or on foot, and people just started picking up the logs and just, like, carrying them out of the monastery. Someone showed up with a chainsaw, and it was, like, the most amazing sort of just, like, spontaneous community action. I just remember reflecting that I have a very hard time imagining that happening in, you know, the United States, at least in most places, that if there was a storm, everyone would come out of their houses or apartments and work together to clean it up. Yet that's what happened there, and just within, you know, maybe an hour, this whole incredible mess was just completely cleaned up. And I'd kind of just like to end my story about my time there with this sort of special story, which is dear to me, about generosity and never knowing sort of where you'll receive teachings or from whom. So when we were leaving the monastery, we stopped by another monastery just to drop a monk off there. We just stayed there for like an hour. And we were invited in to sort of have an audience with the teacher. He didn't speak any English, but he spoke in Thai to the people who were with us. And he had this big, gigantic bowl next to him, like as wide around as a person or something. And I couldn't tell what was in it, but what was in it was candy. And so we were like sitting, like, you know, in this circle around him. He like reached in and threw us all candy, which was very odd, but again, just like giving. And then they brought us like these really kind of sickeningly sweet milky drinks, like in a sort of like juice box. They really loved that stuff there, and like water. And so they gave all this stuff to us that I didn't really want, to be honest, because I don't like sweets that much, and it was all very sweet. And so I just decided to give candy to like the hostel that we were staying with when we got back. But I was looking for someone that I could give this like really sweet milky drink that I had to. And actually at that point there had just been a military coup in the country, which surprisingly wasn't that big of a deal, but for some reason most of the homeless people were gone. And so I had a really hard time finding homeless people. Yeah, I know, it's a little disconcerting. Clay. And, you know, so I kept, like, I was looking that whole day for someone that appeared needy that I could, like, give these drinks to. And I'd kind of basically given up, but at the end of the day, I was sitting in a little cafe drinking some tea with Laura, and I finally noticed someone across the street who appeared to be homeless. They were carrying around, like, a very large amount of plastic bags, and so I ran out of the cafe and I ran over to him and I, you know, bowed as is cultural to do there, and I offered him the drink, and he was this old man, and everyone there is always very excited to practice their English, and so he was kind of like, oh, so, you know, where are you from? And I said, oh, you know, America. And he said, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a student. And then he said, like, and what do you study? And I, you know, wasn't studying yet, but I said, oh, I'll be studying Buddhism. And he just stopped, and then he just like looked at me deep in the eye, and he just said, I love you. And it was just this beautiful, beautiful gift from someone that, you know, is so easy to think has nothing to give, kind of. And I just said back to him, I love you too. And he just bowed and went on his way, and I went on my way. And so that was just such a touching experience for me, to both to see generosity given from someone who I perceive as not having much to give, and just to realize how much they really do have to give, how much all of us has to give. I just kind of like to conclude by, because noting with one more story that didn't actually happen in Thailand or anywhere in Southeast Asia, but just reflects that this generosity isn't limited to Southeast Asia. You can find it here too. And it was just maybe 2 weeks ago, I was riding the CTA, riding the train from Ancient Dragon back to Hyde Park. And I was just sort of reflecting on this spirit of generosity and noticing it not being incredibly present in myself, and just putting some sort of slight energy into sort of cultivating that, just that heart or that spirit of generosity. And I'm sitting on this train, there wasn't many people, but maybe there was someone like about there, and he also appeared to like maybe be homeless. I couldn't quite figure it out. He was at least maybe borderline, for whatever that means. And it was really interesting, because as I just sort of uplifted myself and just sort of brought just the slightest intention to sort of putting some energy into this sort of like generous heart, it seemed as if he sort of noticed instantly, and he kind of like looked over at me, and then he started sort of rustling through a bag that he had, and he pulls out a banana and he just hands it to me. And I was kind of like, and he was like, you wanna? And he said that he was allergic to bananas and he couldn't eat them. And I was just like, well, okay. And it was just, you know, such an incredibly kind gift. You know, usually don't see people handing out food on the CTA, and to have this person who appeared to maybe be homeless, you know, giving me a banana was just another act of sort of just like the beauty of generosity, and also just showed how this mentality of poverty is really just a mentality, and we can always be giving. And so I think I'd like to close there. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Will. So we have some time if anyone has responses or comments or questions for Will, please.
Thanks, Will. Those are really great stories. I feel a little bad. I hadn't heard them before. I went twice in the course of your talk. You used at different junctures of this trip. You said you found X or Y incredibly rewarding. Could you tell me what does that?
God. Sure. Thank you. I mean, Buddha. I mean, it's because of this trip that I see myself having set foot on sort of the Buddhist path. After coming back from Southeast Asia, one of the most important things I realized was the value of a teacher. I'd never had someone who I could really turn to with that much sort of respect or authority or veneration until I met this guy in Thailand, and afterwards kind of realized that that was really important. And so I reached out and developed a relationship with a teacher after coming back, which has in and of itself been just like an incredible act of generosity again. I began practicing the precepts for the first time, another thing which I always sort of said, I don't really want to do that. And noticed all these subtle sort of neuroses and ways which I was just sort of causing suffering in my life that I don't think I would have noticed and been able to overcome to some degree if I hadn't have begun practicing those. I mean, kind of the list goes on. It's like, how does the Buddhist path benefit us? Kind of, it's like, so.
So I was asking.
In many ways. And the humility, too, I think, is one of the greatest gifts that I got from all my time there.
Did you... Sorry, can I ask one more?
Yeah.
Did you know, before you left, that you would be going to divinity school? Or was that decision something that came out of this experience?
No, that's a good question. I forgot to mention that. That was another reason why I was just starting to sort of think about what tradition am I? Do I want to identify with Buddhism, or maybe I'm a Unitarian Universalist, or maybe I'm just an atheist or an agnostic? Or because I had applied to divinity school up to and then at the beginning of my trip, it was like the process of applying. And so, you know, there's many questions in the interview process and in the application process about you and your story and how you identify or don't identify. So, I mean, if anything, it almost made me second guess whether or not I should go to divinity school or if I should just live in Thailand forever. So.
I'm glad you came.
Thank you. Thank you, Tegan.
Just one comment on your observation about South Asian Buddhist temples mostly being about praising Buddha is the way that you said. My experience of being in Japan, too, there are people who do meditation, but most of Asian Buddhism is about venerating Buddha, and that what that means, it can be very wide, of course, but there's a devotional element to most Asian Buddhism, and I think as Americans and my generation, and since people have come to Zen particularly wanting some practice, and so we have that. But also part of our practice is, you know, the forms we just did.
Yeah, and I'll say a word about that, because I didn't mean for it to sound like praising Buddha is a terrible thing. It was just an intimidating thing to hear someone say then. But I mean, I'd say that's kind of another thing which I was a little bit hesitant to open up to before going, and which I came to really look up to and respect and uphold was just veneration in general. It doesn't, you know, I think it, to some degree it matters what you venerate, but just like veneration in general. The teacher in Thailand, the sort of customary way to come into his presence, kind of, if he's like giving a teaching or you're going to meet with him, is to prostrate three times. And that was something which at first I was very uncomfortable doing. I was like, I don't prostrate to anyone or anything. Like, that's not, you know, something I do. But again, became just like this incredible symbol of humility and respect. So.
Thank you for sharing this. So, the practice in Southeast Asia is quite different from Zen. And I wonder how, what you're doing here.
There's lots of reasons I'm here, but to
this particular, you know, practice.
Yeah. Practice. I mean, to answer your question, yeah, a little more directly. Well, one thing that happened is that I spent last summer living at Upaya, which is a Zen monastery in New Mexico, and so that's kind of where I first got exposed to many of these. Forms and particular traditions. The first form of Buddhism which I was actually exposed to was in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. My mom became interested in him when I was in middle school and like convinced me to meditate a couple times, even though I didn't really like it as a middle schooler. But you know, I mean, it's interesting that you say it's different, because I still actually practice with a teacher who teaches Vipassana. And when I first came here and began talking with Taigen about, you know, I have a Vipassana background, but I'm interested in this sort of Zen stuff and want to learn more about it, like, but I don't know how contradictory it is. And I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I think I remember you saying something about how the actual, at least meditation practice, can be fairly similar. And as I've been over here over the course of the year trying to understand more what the actual Zen practice is, and how it compares or contrasts to the Vipassana or Theravadan practice, which I was exposed to before. Sure, there are differences, but I actually find that they speak to each other and relate a lot more than, for example, other forms of Theravada Buddhism. Like, there's a big debate in Theravada Buddhism practices about, like, oh, do you concentrate on one thing, or are you sort of more open awareness? And I was always exposed to the more open awareness side of things, which, not that there's no concentration, but just sort of, it almost is like the Theravada Buddhism, which I've been exposed to, in some ways relates more to Soto Zen, as far as I can tell, than even some other types of Theravada Buddhism relate to that. I don't know if that answered your question.
Just curious.
Yeah. Thank you. Sure.
I'll hold some of the car. So there was this thing that came up earlier talking about you're witnessing this very emotional practice that did not sort of cohere with your notion of what Buddhism was about. And it sounded like you kind of deferred to that. It's like, you said, well, these people have more of a right to claim that than I do. You know, and now you've seen like a variety of practices around the States and in Asia. And I'm wondering, do you think in that same way about who has a right to, what's the criteria? Do we need to say more?
Yeah. I don't think I think in the same way. I think I realize that there's like different ways to practice Buddhism, and my time in Southeast Asia did leave me with a certain realism, I guess you could say, that Buddhism is composed of humans. And, you know, as I've, you know, been in divinity school and studied the history of Buddhism and like learned that, for example, in like Tibet, there was like, you know, giant wars between the different monasteries, like wars, you know, like I just kind of like, you know, recognize that Buddhism is a lived tradition, which is composed of humans, which make mistakes, but there's also variety and diversity, and American Buddhism, whatever that really is also part of the tradition. And I think we're kind of finding out, you know, it seems like we're in an age that's figuring out what is American Buddhism.
So we'll know in a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
So
they'll look back.
I want to just say a little bit about the devotional part that you've talked about in our practice, which seems austere, but really this idea of venerating Buddha, if we understand Buddha as that which is awake in all of us and in everything, then what we do by sitting upright and being present and paying attention is venerating Buddha, sitting like Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
So if this time, if one more comment or question or response. Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you, Tegan.
And for being here. And we'll continue to be here as our UC Divinity School intern, and I hope for long beyond that. And so thank you for being part of our Sangha.
Thank you all for welcoming me.